Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, Thanksgiving is right around the corner. And later in the hour, we're going to talk with Priya Parker. She's an expert on gatherings and how to be a great guest if you're going to someone else's house for Thanksgiving this year. And first, we're going to get some expert cooking advice and inspiration from Chef Vivian Howard. So about 10 years ago, a little documentary series about a chef in a small town in rural North Carolina debuted on PBS. It was called A Chef's Life. And our guest, Vivian Howard, was that chef. And it was special because this show had, like, no flash, no bang, just real stories of what it's like for a brilliant but unpretentious chef to run a restaurant and hang out with farmers. And by the time the show ended, five seasons later, it'd been nominated for 8 Emmy Awards, winning 2, and it won a Peabody Award. And even with the cameras off, Vivian's continued to champion her farmers and run a restaurant called The Chef and the Farmer. That's in Kinston, North Carolina, and she has new restaurants too in Charleston, South Carolina. She's also the author of Deep Run Roots and This Will Make It Taste Good. She joins us now. Hey, Chef, it's great to see you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Hey, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I think when it comes to Thanksgiving, most chefs I know are basically in one of two camps. Like, one camp is, oh my God, I absolutely love it. I love to cook at home for friends and family. I'm always cooking in the restaurant for guests. And the other camp are people like, all I can think about is how to keep 200 gallons of mashed potatoes warm during service. I can't even think about anything else. Do either of these descriptors fit you?
I'm in the first camp. Actually, Thanksgiving, I would say, is my favorite holiday.
Really?
Yes. Your expectations are generally met. And there's no, like, gift giving. Not that I hate gifts, but it's a holiday that is really about the food for me. And I do like cooking at home. It's very different than cooking in a restaurant. So,
sure. What's Thanksgiving like in your home?
Kind of loud, and my, I live across the road from my parents and mm-hmm. much of my extended family, and they just want to eat as early as possible. So they're in my house waiting for the meal to be ready, an hour and a half before it is. So that's the, like, stressor memory that I have.
It's nothing like getting up at 3 in the morning and start roasting your turkey, I guess.
Right.
It's like Thanksgiving breakfast.
Yeah, well, we do wait till lunch.
Okay, right on. Do you do turkey?
Yes. I mean, I think you have. I mean, I feel like I have to. Sure. One year we went totally non-traditional, but I've never done that since.
So, what's unspoken are the conversations that were had afterwards.
Right.
Well, how do you do a turkey? Do you do it the same way every year? Or do you, like, mix it up one year or the next?
So for about probably 10 years, I did this. I would brine the turkey in, a pine needle, rosemary, very fall smelling brine. And mm-hmm. then I would butter roast it. So, like, I'd get a cheesecloth and melt a whole bunch of butter, like an ungodly amount, like 3 pounds. And then I would dip the cheesecloth, like, little square in the butter, and then lay that on top of the bird and do that, 8 times over the course of its cooking. And then the last, 30 minutes, remove all the butter basting and just let that little square brown. It's pretty great.
Wow. Is that a method you came up with, or is that something you picked up somewhere?
Well, it's a combination of methods. The butter basting thing I got from Patrick O'Connell's cookbook.
Mm, okay.
And it ends up like, you know, you have so much kind of accumulated butter and renderings in the bottom of the roasting pan that it really sets you up to make gravy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun. It's like, when is like it okay
really
to do that?
Beautiful, you know? Emulsified gravy.
Yeah. When is it okay to, like, you know, baste something in just
3 pounds of butter?
Yeah, just on Thanksgiving. And then the rosemary pine needle brine is, I don't know where that came from, but the thing about that brine is when the turkey is roasting, it smells amazing. It smells like, you know, almost fake. It's so perfect.
It smells fake. It smells fake in here, y'all. No, it's just
smells like a Thanksgiving candle.
I never thought that would smell good, but now that you're talking about it, I'm like, okay, I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that. And how do you do that, Brian? Do you just grab the pine needles from a tree outside?
What yes. do you do? Well, you know, I live in North Carolina, and our state tree is the longleaf pine. So,
very nice.
But I make the brine with salt, sugar, water, rosemary, sage, pine needles from the tree, juniper, allspice, cloves. Mm. So all of that together with the butter is the Thanksgiving turkey scent. Thanksgiving candle awesome. Turkey.
It's got to smell incredible. Even though you keep insisting on calling it the Thanksgiving candle.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
Well, we have so many callers who wanted to talk with you. So let's, I would love to keep talking about your pine needle butter basted turkey, but let's get to the callers.
Hi, this is John in Tampa. My wife and I are big fans of yours. Her family hails from Mississippi, and my family hails from Florida, and we have a friendly debate every year at Thanksgiving and Christmas because her family is a rice family and mine is a potato family. Both Southerners, but we disagree on the key staple at the table. And I'm wondering if you have a preference during the holidays, and maybe you can help us break the tie. Thank you.
I feel like whatever I'm going to say is probably not going to land in the right way for at least one of them, but...
Oh, we're not divisive in this country at all. Don't worry about it.
No, not at all. well, that's a great question because I grew up in a house where we always had rice and gravy at the holidays, and I never got it. Like, I wanted, like, smooth mashed potatoes and gravy, but nowadays, I have a soft spot for the rice and gravy on Thanksgiving because it reminds me of growing up. So on Thanksgiving, I have rice and gravy, but then on Christmas, because I think often I'll have beef on Christmas, we have mashed potatoes. So you could resolve all of this by just noting, you know, doing one at Thanksgiving and one at Christmas.
Yeah. That was extremely diplomatic.
Yes,
I love that.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I'm Chinese, so like I obviously have a rice thing, but man, rice and gravy is so good.
It's so good.
It's like the texture. I mean, whatever. I love a mashed potato and gravy, but like rice, where you get that little chewiness. Like gravy is so, a good gravy, right? Is so like deep in flavor and like thick and silky and voluptuous. And the way it surrounds a grain of rice and you still get that chew, I think it's so good. Like on mashed potatoes, like it kind of just sort of all becomes the same thing.
Yes.
You know, it's like it mixes together, which is also great. I don't want any, you know, disagreements.
No, no.
No more divisiveness here.
I think you're right. You sold me on the rice with the gravy coated over it. So that's, again, I think you could split it up. Thanksgiving rice and gravy, Christmas mashed potatoes.
Yeah, I've never turned away gravy from my mashed potatoes, but now you mention it, I do think the very best mashed potatoes are the ones that really, truly just taste like potato. Like,
yes.
Just the amazing flavor. Well, that.
And butter.
Half its weight in butter.
Butter.
But yeah, I think like that is such a pure pleasure. Yeah, I guess I don't need gravy with that.
No.
All right, cool. Let's go to another caller. This is Lori.
Hi, this message is for Vivian Howard, Chef Vivian. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia. I was calling with a question about Brussels sprouts. What is the best way to cut them, dice them, shred them? Do you prefer olive oil, avocado oil, or any kind of animal fat? Is it pork or duck? And as far as seasonings go, we got the classic salt and pepper, obviously. But what's something that can totally jazz it up with a spice? Yeah, that's my question. What's the best way to jazz up some Brussels sprouts? Thank you so much.
Jazzy sprouts.
Jazzy sprouts. First of all, give them that name, Jazzy sprouts. Yes. Well, thanks, Lori. So, okay, Jazzy sprouts, go.
Well, Brussels sprouts over the last like 5 years, I would say, have really been having a moment. Don't you think, Francis?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's funny. I kind of feel like at first it was ironic.
Yes.
Like the cliche in our generation is always like, oh, Brussels sprouts.
Yes. Ugh. I hated them before I even knew them.
Exactly. And I feel like someone somewhere, first of all, was like, but have you ever fried them? And then you're like, oh, or have you ever roasted them? And I think then it became this thing where it's like, oh, it became fun and cool to start making this thing delicious that everyone thinks they hate. But anyway, we don't have to go there. But yes, you're right. Everyone now loves Brussels sprouts. But how do you make them extra, extra?
Well, I mean, you know, the Brussels sprouts that we, you know, maligned when we were young were always presented like boiled, you know, and I can't imagine eating a boiled Brussels sprout today or then, you know, dry heat is really great for Brussels sprouts. And I like to quarter them if they're large. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really have two oils in my house. Well, three. So I have grapeseed and I have olive oil, and then I do have, you know, animal fats, but I would crank up my oven really high, like 450, and, toss them with some grapeseed oil and roast them in a single layer on the middle rack of my oven for like 15 minutes and they get super crispy. And then you can like glaze them. You know, I like to take like a little bit of like, you could take honey and add some chili flakes and some grated garlic to that and heat it briefly and then just glaze that over the Brussels sprouts when they come out.
Yes.
You know, there's really no limit to what you could put on it. But I do like to drag the like crispy Brussels sprout through something, you know, so whether it be like a creamy, like an aioli or like a sweet and sour glaze, like I think that makes it like really jazzy, really jazzy. I've got jazz hands here. You can't see them.
Totally. I love that the fingers are going nuts. Coming up, the Brussels sprout conversation continues. More with Chef Vivian Howard and your Thanksgiving cooking questions. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space.
and listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're getting ready for Thanksgiving this week, just as you probably are. And to help, we've got the star of A Chef's Life on PBS, Vivian Howard, to help take your questions. We're in the middle of a spirited conversation about Brussels sprouts, so let's get back to it.
You know, the thing with Brussels sprouts, or actually like broccoli, cauliflower, like all the cruciferous vegetables, when they are roasted or pan-seared, when they get that nice browning, that caramelization, they have such a delicious cabbage. I mean, like all these like non-sexy vegetables, like once someone discovered you can hit them with high heat, they just totally transform.
I love the comparison of Brussels sprouts to cabbage because they are kind of like little cabbages.
Yeah, totally.
And I love to take a head of cabbage and cut it into like eighths, leave the core intact, and then get a skillet really, really hot and sear the cabbage on the first side and then turn it over and do it on the other. And, you know, that's something that you find in the grocery store year round. Brussels sprouts aren't necessarily that where I live.
Yeah, totally.
And you could do all the same things with cabbage that you're doing with the Brussels sprouts. And it kind of ends up tasting the same. It kind of reminds me of like popcorn, the flavor of caramelized.
Yes, great call.
Yes, Brussels sprouts caramelized like that and cabbage. Something always makes me think of popcorn.
Great, great call. Totally, totally. And actually, okay, now we've just like sang the praises of Brussels sprouts. I actually kind of prefer cabbage because I still like that crunch.
Mm-hmm. Yes, me too.
Like the texture of cabbage still has a little crunch even when you get a good hard sear on it. And it actually reminds me too of this really awesome, super fast meal that my friend's wonderful writer Molly Weisenberg and her ex-partner Brandon Pettit, who's a great chef in Seattle, wrote about a long time ago. And like just like a total weeknight dinner, you dice up some cabbage, get a pan ripping crazy hot, like you said, throw the cabbage in there, spread it out, let it sear. You get some of that popcorny smell, salt, toss, a little bit of sriracha or whatever kind of like chili sauce you like, toss that just to kind of finish it. Oh, sorry, a little bit of soy sauce. So soy sauce and the sriracha or whatever chili sauce or chili paste. Just a simple stir fry kind of thing. No aromatics needed. Just those two things. And a fried egg on top with a bowl of rice. And they're like, oh, we eat this for dinner like twice a week. And I tried it. I'm like, I'll eat this three times a week.
Yeah.
Like,
and
it's so good.
Something everybody has around again.
Yeah.
And the caramelization of the cabbage does amazing things. Yeah.
Totally. Right on. Okay. We could talk about cruciferous vegetables all day long, but instead we have another question for you.
Hello. I'm Sharon from Seattle.
Sharon.
I'm a pretty confident home cook. I love to bake, make all kinds of savory dishes, and the very idea of turning on the oven, well, it makes me grin. But I wish I had a better grasp of how to plate and garnish to make food look extra special. Can you offer me some tips on garnishes that go beyond boring old parsley? Thank you.
Oh, Sharon, that was a great question.
I know.
I'm going to remove myself from this conversation because when I did like the plating exercise in skills one in culinary school, the chef looked at me and just said, we're going to move to the next student.
You were lacking that finesse.
No, it is not my forte.
Plating is actually something that I enjoy. And it's true that you can, you know, in a professional kitchen, you can kind of see the people that have that in their skill set, you know, that they have that finesse. We also call it soigner. I actually never called it that, but I heard some chefs calling it that. You know, one of my favorite kind of techniques just for making a plate look nice is to think about the colors, you know, like the reason that we associate parsley as a garnish is because it is kind of a brilliant herb in that you can douse it with acid, you can season it with salt, and like an hour later, it's still going to be like bright and voluptuous. There's not really
bright green, yeah.
So there's like not
like
really
basil will turn brown.
Exactly, basil, mint, sage. basically any other herb is going to turn brown when introduced to acid or salt. But one of my favorite things that you probably have in your fridge to add both like beauty and a bright herbal note are celery leaves. You know, if you buy a bunch of celery, you know, in the center are all these like light green, like almost fluorescent leaves that taste incredibly fresh. So if you have a dish that has celery somewhere layered in it, let's say you've got like braised short ribs on mashed potatoes, like brown on brown, you could make a little celery salad to go on top of that. So celery, maybe orange zest, orange juice, lemon juice, maybe even some diced Granny Smith apple in there. And that's going to add both texture and color and like a whole nother dimension of flavor to that dish. Also, something that most of us have are scallions or green onions. So one of the ways that we make things look nice in the restaurant is not just like buying different ingredients, but treating them differently. So you can take scallions and rather than just slicing them, you know, straight across, we cut them on what we call a severe bias. So you're going to like cut your scallion very long and angular. And then when you like put it on top of your dish, it looks like it took you a long time to slice that.
So instead of like rings, you turn it at an angle, and when you're slicing it, it comes out like a very long ribbon.
Yes. Okay. So like on a bias, but then we say a severe bias, or that's what I say. Yeah. That's how I talk, I guess. Yeah. also, plate like somebody's watching, you know, if you want it to look nice, think about height, you know, think about what would this look like in a restaurant? And you know, have fun with it.
Yeah.
Like I never add an inedible garnish. There's, you know, like a sprig of rosemary or something that's not going to add to the flavor or the texture or make the dish better in some way. Mm-hmm. One of my pet peeves is like when you go into a restaurant and the chef has just like strewn microgreens all over the top of the dish to make to make it look fancy,
even though it doesn't add anything to it.
Even though they have wilt from the heat before you get it to the table. But always think about, you know, adding something to make the dish better. You know, this little salad on top of, you know, a rice dish that we were just talking about, you could use radishes, shaved radishes, which is something that a lot of people have in their fridge. So radishes with the herbs and then the scallion. And you've got a robust little pretty salad with multiple colors, and it's going to make it taste better.
Yeah, and just a little lemon juice and olive oil and a little pinch of salt. And just brighten the whole thing up too. Cool. All right, let's take another call.
Hi, my name is Julia. I recently tried to make bananas Foster after eating it at a restaurant and really enjoying the spectacle. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I failed to light the rum on fire. I kept pouring more rum in. I added other liquors. It ended up swimming in alcohol and still barely lighting on fire. Still tasted good, but I'm wondering what I did wrong, if I used the wrong kind of rum, if there's a technique to it. In any case, I would appreciate it because I would love to use it as a party trick next time I have people over for dinner. Thank you.
All right, Chef.
I'm going to back away.
It's flambé time.
I'm going to back away from this because I really, you know, I don't know. I have one thought, but I want to hear what you're going to say first.
Okay. Well, I think basically from a technical standpoint, I think what she should have done that she probably didn't do was heat the rum first on the stove. So if you like take a match to a shot of whiskey, you take a match to, you know, any kind of alcohol, it's not actually going to light on fire. But if you heat it up, it's literally just hotter. So it's closer to the ignition point. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about like the volatiles of the alcohol actually start to come out and they will ignite when the flame comes near it or whatever. But I was always taught if you're flambéing, you always have to warm the alcohol. You don't have to like boil it like crazy, but certainly get it nice and hot where it's almost like steamy hot. And don't pour a ton of it all at once because it's still liquid. So pour a little bit of it and then get it hot and then get your flame in there. And I go, whoo, whoo. But I actually have I want to hear your thought, and then if we have time, I will share my both hilarious and incredibly embarrassing flambé story.
Well, my thought, I did not know that, Francis, and so thank you. My thought
you don't have
was
to work in the front of the house.
No, that's true. That's true. And our restaurant actually burned after being open for 5 years, and so we just kind of
I'm sorry.
We shied away from any flambe.
Open flames and new
it's like, you know, not going to test.
We just rebuilt.
Yeah. But I was thinking, like, maybe I think it probably it couldn't hurt to use something like 151. Rum, like that has a very high alcohol content, because you know some of the dark rums and everything, I think they're like maybe only 30 or 40 proof, so that could have something to do with it. I don't even know if they still sell 151, but I used to drink it in college, I think.
You're North Carolina, you can find some moonshine.
yeah true.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Like, definitely make sure it's a relatively high proof alcohol. Yeah, if you're doing something that's, and definitely, Julia, warm it up on the stovetop. Since you mentioned wanting to do it as a sort of party trick and showstopper, I will give you some warnings. One is make sure there is nothing flammable nearby. And I am like, it sounds like, haha, of course. No, I'm serious. Like, don't do it near your carpet. Don't do it near your curtains. And really think about doing it in a place where you have really high ceilings.
So tell us your story, Francis. It sounds like...
Okay. So here I am in culinary school. I am, I don't know, a week from graduation, 2 weeks from graduation. And the very last course we had in culinary school was like front of the house. And the school I was in this like traditional, like formal French fine dining style of restaurant. And one of the things they would sort of put on the menu so that we had the opportunity to go do like tableside service would be like a show-stopping kind of dessert. And I loved it because I love to talk to people and I love to like ham it up. And like if someone orders the Bananas Foster, I'm like, oh, I'm psyched. I'm like, I'm going to go wheel the cart over and, you know, get the bananas going. They had taught me this cool trick on how you can peel a banana without touching it with your hands.
Wow.
So it looks very classy. You're only using like the fork and knife to peel the banana. You cut it into a pan on a little burner we have on the cart, the guéridon, as we called it. And then, you know, you'd be chatting, you're making your witty jokes, and then you pour in your hot rum and you flambe it and everyone goes, ooh, great, and you pour it over ice cream. So I loved it. I had a ball doing it. And then like 3 days before graduation, they changed the menu. So now it was Cherry's Jubilee instead of Bananas Foster. And what I noticed with the Cherry's Jubilee, we would flambe it with kirsch, which is like a cherry liqueur. And it had this incredibly beautiful blue flame. And like on the red cherry, it just looked phenomenal. And so like the oohs and ahs are even more now, right? Because you have this gorgeous blue flame, the red cherries, the whole shebang. I'm about to graduate. I'm feeling it. I'm lit. This is great. Straight A's. Here we go. It's our last service. It's my last time doing the Cherry's Jubilee. And I'm like, I'm going to do this right. And it's like normally it's like a 3-count pour of the kirsch. And I was like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7, 8, 9. I am just, you know, this is it, right? I light that thing and my whole life flashes before my eyes. And I see this blue fireball, like Dragon Ball Z anime, you know, like just coming straight for my head. I duck out of the way. I hear my instructor from the other end of the dining room go, oh my God. And, you know, ever the consummate professional, I stand back up and I keep, you know, pouring the cherries over the ice cream with this like giant blue flame or whatever. And I'm just smelling the smell of burnt hair.
Oh, my gosh.
and so my instructor comes over and says, when you're done with that, you might want to go take a break.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, please let me have eyebrows. Please let me have eyebrows.
Nothing like burnt hair to get you ready for
dessert. Yeah, that was like the night before graduation from culinary school.
You were flying too close to the sun.
Yeah, that was a definite Icarus moment.
Yes.
All right, let's go to another caller.
Hi, this message is for Chef Vivian. I am interested in knowing some ideas for holiday gifts. I love to cook for people at the holidays and make something they can take home with them or drop off for a neighbor. I don't particularly like to do cookies because I don't have much of a sweet tooth and I'm not a great baker. I prefer to do something savory, and I've done spiced nuts and I've done cheese straws. And I'm wondering if there's something else that's portable that's a little different this year that I can do for people. Thank you so much.
All right.
I love this question so much.
Yeah,
I love to give consumable gifts, and I love to receive consumable gifts.
Right on.
So I wrote a cookbook 2-3 years ago called This Will Make It Taste Good. And every chapter in that book is about like a flavor hero that I use to make simple food really exciting. So two of my favorite chapters are the one called Little Green Dress and the one called Red Weapons. And so Red Weapons are pickled Roma tomatoes, essentially. So you make a brine with olive oil and sugar and vinegar and a bunch of aromatics, lots of scallions and garlic and ginger, lots of spices. And you heat that up and you pour it over quartered Roma tomatoes just from the grocery store. They don't have to be perfect and straight from the garden or anything. Pour that over them and let that sit overnight and then pack that into jars. And what you will be giving people is an incredible ingredient that they can fold into scrambled eggs. They can put it on top of a baked potato with Parmesan cheese, blend it up for salsa. It also, you end up with kind of a vinaigrette, if you will, because you have the olive oil brine, and it's excellent stirred into creamy dressings or whisked with a little bit of extra lemon juice. So you've made three products in one. And that's
love
great.
That.
Little Green Dress is basically like a chimichurri and a salsa verde had a baby in a bed of olives. And it's a great thing to give somebody around the holidays because it's excellent on beef or chicken. You know, it's something that they could actually serve with their Christmas Eve meal. They could have it on eggs in the morning following. I mean, it's so versatile. That's why it's called the little green dress, you know, like your little black dress. It goes with everything.
Yeah. So how do you make that?
So basically all you need is a food processor, and it's parsley, the whole parsley, like stems and everything, mint, garlic, shallots, red wine or sherry vinegar, capers, and lots of chopped up Castel Vetrano olives. I am peculiar about
so
the type of olive.
They're super buttery.
And
like mild flavor, but really buttery and good, yeah.
And a couple anchovies go in there. If you're turned off by anchovies, you can leave it out, but I encourage you not to.
Yeah, they're great.
And so then that all just gets blended up, and you've got like a green, meaty kind of sauce because of all the olives. And sometimes I put a little honey in the end just because sometimes those herbs can present a little bitter, or the shallot can present bitter. So you can adjust with a little honey. But I think that those are two just amazing consumable gifts that people can enjoy more than once. You know, with spiced nuts or something like that, it's kind of like you have it and then it's gone. And this is kind of a gift that keeps giving.
Yeah, totally. Well, especially if you're like, oh, this is the sauce for your you know, holiday dinner. Like, what an incredible present to not have to worry about that piece of dinner.
Yes.
Right on.
Yes.
Those are great ideas. Well, thank you. And this has been so fun. Thanks so much for coming by, Chef.
My pleasure. I love talking. So to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Vivian Howard is the author of Deep Run Roots, and her latest book is This Will Make It Taste Good. You can find her recipe for that rosemary pine needle brine, now forever known as the Thanksgiving-scented candle turkey brine, and her little green dress sauce at splendidtable.org. Coming up, you want to be a good host, sure, but you definitely want to be a great guest, right? Well, Priya Parker has some things that you can keep in mind. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table for APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. When we last had Priya Parker on our show a couple years ago, it was on the cusp of the first holiday season of the pandemic. She'd just written a book called The Art of Gathering, and so we talked about how to have a meaningful Thanksgiving over Zoom. We did it by really digging into what the gathering means. Well, I'm so happy to have her back, and this year, it's not about hosting a Zoom call, or even about how to host a great Thanksgiving Day feast. She's really thought a lot about the other side of it lately, how to be a great guest. Hey, Priya, it's so great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you literally wrote the book on gathering. You're an expert on the art of gathering. And I think a lot of people interpret that as hosting or organizing a gathering. But a little while ago in your newsletter, you wrote about how to be a good guest rather than being a good host. And, you know, we're not talking about how to be a good guest like, oh, should you always bring something? Do you bring red or do you bring white? You know, not like that kind of etiquette stuff. But you wrote about, like, these ideas of good guesting and like a sort of a definition of what it means to be a good guest. So let's just start there. What to you is good guesting?
This work is called The Art of Gathering, not The Art of Hosting, in part right. because I believe guests have a lot of power to shape a gathering. Mm-hmm. And most of us are actually guests much more often than we're hosts. That's certainly true for me.
Yeah.
And a guest is part of the social contract of the gathering. If you don't have guests, you don't have a gathering.
Sure.
And so part of this premise of what I call the art of guesting is to really deeply think, just as a host, an artful host, begins to, well before the gathering begins, intentionally think about the purpose of the gathering, of the need of the gathering, of who should be there. Similarly, when you are invited to attend a gathering, to really deeply think about whether you want to attend it, why you want to attend it, how do you want to show up, how do you meaningfully say no if you don't want to attend it. And the invitation is really, particularly as we're beginning to approach the holidays, how do we intentionally not just host specific gatherings, but how do we intentionally guest, attend, mindfully show up to the things we choose to be at?
Mm-hmm. And so in the newsletter, you lay out these principles of good guesting. I wonder if you can maybe walk us through them and tell us what they mean. One of them I remember was really interesting was, you know, to be a good guest, you should think like a host. What do you mean by that?
I was recently at a housewarming party where during dinner, there were maybe 12 guests around a table. It was at a couple's new house. And people were excited to be there. You know, we kind of ostensibly knew why we were there. It was called a housewarming party. And in the middle, maybe like 10 or 15 minutes into the dinner, a guest leaned over to the host with kind of a twinkle in her eye. And she asked the host, would you mind if I asked the group what their favorite part of your new home is?
Oh, cool.
And the host said, you know, sure. And this guest kind of clinked her glass. She stood up and she just said, we're here in our friend's beautiful new home. And she was so curious to hear everyone's favorite thing about their friend's new home. And one by one, the friends kind of and family went around and, you know, talked about a specific detail in the living room or, you know, photos of, you know, multi-generational family already on the wall in this room. And basically, this guest helped the gathering kind of achieve its purpose in this really generous way. She basically, as a guest, looking around the table, was kind of observing and realizing we are all here, like, ostensibly for this underlying purpose. And if a host is kind of issuing this call, right, this call, come to my home, what this guest was doing underneath was issuing the response. And that response, in a way, was let us tell you, let us reflect back to you what we love about, you know, about this place, what we see, what we witness in you. She created a shared context. And she did a second thing, which really good guests do, is she helped us through this really simple question, make meaning together in this way that in each person's answers, yes, we were looking at our friend's sort of new home, but we also learned a lot about each guest, right? What's their eye? How do they see their space? What are they noticing as they're walking through a room? And so it was this lovely, generous move of a guest to think like a host and then to also help a group kind of land and find its purpose together.
Yeah. You noted in the newsletter that like it would have been super awkward if the host had actually said that, you know, themselves, like, hey, okay, everyone, tell me what you love about this place. You know, that would be odd.
Totally.
But for the guest to do that, you know, that's such a gift to give back to the host, right?
It's such a gift. And part of that, I love that you picked up on that because, you know, I often write that gathering is both about, this is Adam Kahane's language, as if another facilitator, gatherings are both about love and power. Mm. They're about both. They're the navigating of different people at the same moment in time. What are we going to talk about? You know, what are the norms here? And people often think that the host is the person who wields power. But the host wields a very specific type of power, right? Even if you think about in a workplace, there's some things a manager can do and maybe, you know, or a boss and let's talk about such and such. But there's many things that a manager might say and everyone rolls their eyes, right? Oh, here we go again. Sure. Versus like guests have guest power. Guests have the power to basically decide, are we going to go along with this? Is this cool? How are we going to shift, you know, the conversation? And part of what was so generous about what this guest did was she realized it would be a little odd, like tell me how, you know, great this place is, right? And by realizing that she uniquely could ask this in a way that would help the group realize, yeah, maybe we should do this, she was actually incredibly helping the host do something that in some ways wasn't the role of the host to do.
Right. You also mentioned this idea of meaning making, which I think is so interesting. And this is sort of what we talked about last time, you know, you and I got together and we talked about, oh, how do we have holiday festive gatherings over Zoom, right? When, you know, far fewer people felt safe getting together physically. And you talked a lot about that, that idea of like, well, we have to think about what the meaning of the gathering is and kind of, you know, say it out loud. So we all kind of know what we're there for and really feel what we're there for. And I love that notion too. I mean, the housewarming, sure, is the meaning of the housewarming about, you know, making the host feel great about their new home. Yeah, in part. But also you have this great example of someone who wrote to you on your honeymoon, wrote an email to you and said, this is what I loved so much about your wedding. And I thought, man, you know, what's a better gift than having someone tell you what was magical about the event that you held?
It was this deeply generous act. And so if the first step of good guesting is to think like a host, a second element is to help meaning make. And all of gathering at some level is meaning making, right? What do we gather for? What do we mark? What do we celebrate? What do we talk about? How did that go? And this, you know, the age-old adage that you leave a newlywed couple alone on their honeymoon. We received an email a few days after my husband and I got married, and the subject line of the email was 20 things, and opened it up. We shouldn't have been on our phones, but we opened it up, and there was this beautiful, and honestly, it was probably dashed off on a cell phone boarding a plane to head home. Like, it wasn't, you know, Shakespeare. It was this beautiful 20 bullet list of the 20 things, the 20 moments this friend of my husband loved about our wedding. And many of the moments we didn't even know occurred, right? There were moments between other guests. There were things that she noticed, you know, among some of our family. There were all of, and then some of the moments we totally recognized and gave us a good chuckle and felt so delighted that other people also had the same amount of joy. And, you know, took her probably 5 minutes. And she could have also meaning made in a thank you card, right? I mean, meaning making is basically pausing and helping someone else understand the story of what happened from your eyes. And she did that in this incredible way that helped us as the host say, oh my gosh, this is what transpired there. Oh my gosh, there's 100 different versions of this night. Wow, they also felt this or they felt something different. And as a guest, she took this extra step that helped us kind of exhale, right? You go to a gathering and then you leave, and at least if it's good and if it's meaningful, hosting is a vulnerable act. Even the most beautiful evenings, the next morning you're kind of like, did anyone like that? Right? Like, are there notes here? And one of the most, I think, generous ways to be a guest is to afterwards, if it's true, if it's authentic, to write, to reflect, you know, back to the host, what specifically did you enjoy? What happened there? And the kind of the bigger events, that's even more true.
Yeah. That was great. We had such a great time. Thank you. It's perfectly nice. But to do what you're talking about is really taking it to the next level. Like that's being great.
And part of the meaning making, you know, meaning lies in specificity. And so even just the difference between what you just said of thank you so much for having us, that was great. That's kind of, it's functional. Anyone can say that. But to simply just, it's almost like a good guest and a good host just slightly turns up the dial on context, on specificity. I loved how you served those ramps. I loved the way that you served the chili dogs that you used to love when you were a softball player in high school. Yeah. It was so amazing, right? Whatever it is, the specificity of noticing allows people to realize, wow, my effort was seen, or they had such a good time. And so part of a good guest is to think about how to meaning make in a way that helps people really truly feel appreciated.
Yeah, totally. Let me get to another one. You write that a good guest realizes that like their actions can alter the actions or the behavior of other guests.
I was recently at Bemelman's Bar, which is a kind of iconic bar in New York City. All over these walls are paintings by Ludwig Bemelman, who is the creator of the Madeleine children's books.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went, it was one evening, Saturday evening, maybe around 5:30 or so p.m. And I actually went with my in-laws and my husband, and we walked in, kind of tucked in. We grabbed a little corner table and we just chatted and chatted and chatted. And at one point, maybe 10 minutes in, a piano player, a pianist came in, kind of opened the grand piano and started playing. And we kept on chatting and chatting and chatting. And maybe like 20 minutes in, three guests walked in and took a table, a small little table in front of the piano. And I noticed out of the corner of my eye, they didn't sit where the chairs were placed, like a table of three. You know, usually you almost have chairs in a triangle. They moved all three chairs around to one side to watch the piano player. And after the first song, started basically clapping loudly, like loudly, appreciatively. And everyone turned and looked as if it was like, oh, there's something happening here. And everyone else burst into applause. And the piano player kind of looked up and realized, oh my goodness, like, wow, that was different than the last 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Over the course of the night, basically from that moment on, after every song, everyone was clapping and people started to shift their own seats and started to realize, oh, and those three people, whether they realized it or not, they altered everyone else in the room. They turned us from these small side chats into this shared experience of being an audience. And they did that through a very simple mechanism, but it affected everybody else. And that is true at almost every gathering. The way we gather is contagious. The way we guest is contagious. The way we come together is we are looking towards one another as to how to behave and what is quote unquote normal. And guests can shift that as deeply as a host.
Yeah. Hearing you tell that story kind of warms my heart because I just can't help but think about that piano player who probably plays that piano all night long.
Totally.
Every night as background music and is essentially ignored. And, and for even one night, for them to feel like, wow, these people took the time to actually listen to what I do and to listen to my music, that must have felt amazing. But to your point, too, it's not just about them. Like, to be in that, well, you were in that room. So, like, did it feel like, oh, man, I was, like, having so much fun talking with my in-laws? Or did it feel like, wow, it's so wonderful that we all kind of, I don't know the people sitting next to me, but we're all kind of sharing an experience.
It turned up the magic of the evening. It shifted mm-hmm. very subtly. It shifted it into a different kind of place. You can talk with your friends anywhere, but here we can talk. By the way, we didn't stop talking. It didn't become a silent concert. It mm-hmm. was just between the intervals of songs, all of a sudden there is this jubilee. And yeah. it kind of, again, these guests almost helped the place fulfill its purpose.
Yeah. And you paid more attention to the place that you were in.
How many places listening. Do you have a yeah. grand piano in the middle of the room with an extraordinary talent that you don't have to pay to see in a concert to then, and then begin to sort of infiltrate the space. But the last thing I'll just say on here is they changed the social contract among the guests from these 12 or 20 individual nodes to these mm-hmm. 12 or 20 individual nodes who then were connected through this network of fellow audience members. It shifted yeah. kind of the agreement of the night incredibly yeah, subtly, yeah, yeah. but we all of a sudden belonged to a place.
Yeah, totally. What a wonderful thing to think about as we, think about the holiday gatherings we're going to go to this year. And the lesson obviously is to get a grand piano and put it in the middle of your living room. But I think, to think about how we're in a place and how our actions and our behavior, they really matter, and they matter to everyone in that room, whether we know them or not. So this is really, really lovely, lovely stuff to think about. Thank you so much, Priya.
Thank you so much for having me.
Priya Parker is the author of the terrific book, The Art of Gathering. And she also writes the Art of Gathering newsletter. It's free and you can sign up for it at priyaparker.com. Well, that is our show for this week. But hey, don't forget, on Thanksgiving Day, we'll be coming to you with our annual call-in show, Turkey Confidential. We'll be on the radio or download the podcast. We can't wait to cook with you. Talk to you soon. Have a happy Thanksgiving. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.